For years, people told me, "You look like that lady on Saturday Night Live." One Halloween, I dressed up as Tina Fey. It didn't take much costuming to do it. So when Tina started playing me on SNL, I told the B team, "Hey, I was Tina Fey before she was me." I had liked some seasons of SNL since I was a teenager, sneaking around to watch it so my parents wouldn't catch me. So when she began impersonating me, it was a bit surreal. But from the beginning, I liked the idea that John and I might appear on the show. "Let's do this," I said. "Let's go on and neutralize some of this and have some fun." Of course, the idea was met with massive back and forth haggling. Had we done it back in September, I think we might have had a shot at evening the odds with the SNL crew. As it stood, though, Tina's impression of me became so omnipresent and so unchallenged that some people blurred SNL skit dialogue with what I had actually said. The classic example was Tina, dressed up as me, saying, "I can see Russia from my house," which, of course, I've never said. After that episode, many Alaskans sent me photos of themselves standing on the Alaska shore with Russia visible over their shoulders. Not only can you see it, you can swim to Russia from Alaska, as hardcore athlete Lynn Cox did in 1987. Finally, when it was much too late from a tactical standpoint to say no, headquarters agreed to let us do the show. I was glad about it, but as time passed, I worried that we still hadn't seen a script. Word filtered down from on high, "Don't worry about it, we've got it under control. John and Lauren Michaels are good friends, they're not going to screw you." So we'd wait some more, and we'd bug headquarters some more, and nothing. And there was still nothing on October 18th, the morning we flew into New York City to do the show. "Okay, guys, the show's tonight," I said to the staff. "Where's the script? What if it's raunchy? Worse, what if it's not funny?" This was make-or-break stuff, yet still no script, and with just hours to go, I wanted to see what millions of viewers were going to see. So finally, we B-teamers started brainstorming. What about a skit where I pretended to be a journalist and asked Tina condescending questions? "What do you use for newspapers up in Alaska? Tree bark? What happens if the moose were given guns? It wouldn't be so easy then, eh? Is "You Betcha" your state motto?" We sent our ideas up the line, and somebody smacked them down. Word came back that Lauren was leery of letting Tina and me share the same stage because Tina's liberal politics might cause her to ad-lib something snarky, and that would stick like a burr to the campaign. Obviously, he knew his NBC star better than I did, but I honestly didn't think that was plausible. Finally, someone got us a copy of the script. We were sitting in the Suburban, and Tucker was reading it, laughing out loud. "This is the funniest thing I've ever read, Governor. You have got to read this. Seriously, you're going to laugh your butt off." I looked at the script. SNL writers had taken the campaign's "drill, baby, drill" mantra and turned it into a risque double entendre about Todd and me. I thought, nah, come on, New York talent, we can do better than that. We checked into a hotel before the show. It was Bristol's 18th birthday, so the staff treated her to Magnolia Bakery's famous cupcakes. I think I ate 6. Then we headed for the studios. The campaign's Fay fears turned out to be overblown. Instead, when I met her, she was friendly and gracious, fresh-faced, very petite and wearing jeans. Tina was standing near the wings holding her adorable little girl, Alice, who was about 3. "Don't worry," Tina said when I walked up. "They'll put makeup on me." Then I noticed Alice turning her head back and forth, first to Tina, then to me, then to Tina again. I smiled. "We're confusing your daughter." Tina laughed, without managers and handlers swarming around. "Don't say this, don't say that." It was just a nice mom moment. "Believe it or not, I've got Republicans in my family," Tina said, smiling. "Believe it or not," I said, "I've got Democrats in mine." She told me that her husband's parents were GOP loyalists. I enjoyed meeting them later when they came backstage at a rally. Tina and I chatted for a couple more minutes. Then someone came and whisked me off to a tiny windowless dressing room crammed with a couch, a styling chair, and a brightly lit vanity. Then it seemed for a nice little stretch that I finally had a moment to take a break. Since August 29th, the campaign had been burning fuel at breakneck speed. And now, in this cramped room, that almost faded to the background. The spotty cell phone coverage in there probably helped a bit. In addition to my duties as governor, we'd been plugged into updates and news and headlines and polls and people and headquarters instructions 24/7 for weeks. And now suddenly, it just stopped. And it was nice in that little window of time to be doing just one thing. At some point, Amy Poehler came in. She was very pregnant. She and Bristol compared belly sizes and chatted about all the biological details expectant mother swap. Very nice of Amy, I thought. Very down to earth and funny, of course. Really, everyone in the cast was so friendly and kind to us. There was nothing to fear. During all this, the writers, the producers, and the campaign continued to hammer out the script. Josh Brolin, Mark Wahlberg, and the singer Adele were also on the show that night, as was director Oliver Stone, who made a cameo appearance. Unbelievably, he is a supporter of communist dictator Hugo Chavez, who in a 2006 speech to the United Nations referred to the President of the United States as the devil himself. I did not shake Stone's hand. Alec Baldwin also guested on the show that evening. The bigwigs haggled back and forth over my appearance with Alec. The writer sending down some lines where Alec was basically supposed to perform a comic dissection on me. Then I was supposed to passively take his arm and stroll off stage. From a political messaging standpoint, the campaign could see that wasn't going to work. We put our heads together and sent the producers a counteroffer. Alec would still get his barbs in. Then I would say, "Hey, Baldwin, weren't you supposed to leave the country after the last election?" No, producer said. We tried another idea. It happened that I had recently talked with Alec's brother, Stephen, at a GOP fundraiser. So we sent back another counteroffer based on my actual conversation with Stephen. "Hey, Alec," the proposed line went, "I saw Stephen at a fundraiser last week and asked him when he was going to knock some sense into you." No. What's that line about being able to dish it out? We went around and around until finally the SNL folks agreed to a version of the Steven line that ultimately appeared in my bit with Alec. It was watered down, but I still thought it was a funny piece. I'm standing with Lauren, and Alec walks up and pretends to think I'm Tina as me. "Hey, Lauren." "Hey, Tina," Alec says. "Lauren, I need to talk to you. You can't let Tina go out there with that woman. She goes against everything we stand for. I mean, good Lord, Lauren, they call her, what's that name they call her? Kara, what do they call her again, Tina?" "That'd be Caribou Barbie," I said. "Caribou Barbie, thank you, Tina. I mean, this is the most important election in our nation's history, and you want her, our Tina, to go out there and stand there with that horrible woman? What do you have to say for yourself?" Lauren turned from Alec to me and back again. "Alec, this is Governor Palin." "Hi there," I said. "I must say that your brother Stephen is my favorite Baldwin brother." Then I stepped onto the famous set and got to say the words that had become a permanent part of American culture. "Live from New York, it's Saturday night." The first wardrobe story hit on October 22nd. RNC shells out $150,000 for Palin fashion. The headline was highly misleading, as was the article itself, which said that, according to campaign financial disclosures, the McCain campaign had spent $150,000 to clothe and accessorize vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin and her family. I never asked the New York stylist to purchase clothes. Many of the items were never worn. Many others were intended for the use of other people. And in the end, the wardrobe items were all returned. It certainly wasn't true that I or my family had been on any kind of big-time shopping trips. A Los Angeles Times fashion critic referred to me as a pampered princess and suggested that I had personally spent the money on a one-woman economic stimulus plan. Katie Couric even weighed in on the trumped-up controversy, writing, "There aren't a lot of Joe Sixpacks out there who can drop six figures on a new wardrobe, so Governor Sarah Palin's $150,000 shopping spree seems excessive to some people." This was especially ironic coming from Katie, whose own stylist, the B-team was told, was part of the team the campaign hired to do the convention shopping before I even arrived. I didn't care so much about the petty pot shots because I knew they weren't true, and people who knew me laughed out loud when they read the diva accusations. But my family was made to look like a herd of hillbillies who had come to the big city and started living high on the hog, and that hurt me for them. My family is frugal. We clip coupons. We shop at Costco. We buy diapers in bulk and generic peanut butter. We don't have full-time nannies or housekeepers or drivers. So the portrayal of my family as wasting other people's money on clothes was a false one. And many wondered at the same time why no other candidates or their spouses were being asked a thing about their hair, makeup, or clothes. Elizabeth Hasselbeck had a theory. In late October, the bold and talented View co-host joined us for a bus tour in Florida. I had met her at the GOP convention and found out that we had a mutual friend from Wasilla. Elizabeth joined us at a huge rally in Tampa that took place right after the ridiculous wardrobe story hit the news. Now, with everything going on in the world, this seems a bit odd, Hasselbeck said from the podium before a crowd of thousands. But let me tell you, this is deliberately sexist. The crowd went crazy. Then she joked that the thing that impressed her most about my wardrobe were my accessories, my American flag pin, and the Blue Star military pin I wore in honor of track. The pundits peddling the story that I was this big spending clothes horse didn't list that accessory, Elizabeth said, because they know it's priceless. I was thinking, amen, sister. After Elizabeth introduced me in Tampa, I decided to take the wardrobe story by the horns. But it would just be a quick mention, a candid quote to set the record straight. I'm glad now that Elizabeth brought it up because it gives me an opportunity, without the filter of the media, to tell you the whole clothes thing, I told the cheering crowd. Those clothes, they are not my property, just like the lighting and staging and like everything else the RNC purchases. I'm not taking them with me. I'm wearing my own clothes from my favorite consignment shop in Anchorage, Alaska, right now. There, simple. It was over, and it was truthful. Word quickly came back from headquarters that I'd done it again. I'd gone rogue. What I had actually done was speak up to defend my ethics and my family, but still, the hammer came down. Now, my friends and family sure knew the truth about the clothes, and the campaign folks, especially those who had vetted me and chosen me, also knew the truth. But as the story grew legs, they didn't lift a finger to correct the record. I couldn't understand why until I realized that by the end of the campaign, the wardrobe fairy tale had become convenient. By then, with Obama soaring and our own ticket in free fall, one or two of the campaign's big dogs were already packing their parachutes. By late October, with our numbers bad and some gears inside the campaign definitely out of whack, Nicole Wallace sent around an email suggesting that staffers all get on a conference call to discuss how to improve things. One thing we B-teamers thought was really off-kilter was that the campaign wasn't telling voters everything they needed to know about the other ticket's records, past associations, and future plans, nor was it holding the press accountable for biased reporting. You could feel it. Voters were clamoring for us to take the gloves off. Yet the B-team was reprimanded for trying to shed light on some of these important questions. I later learned from my foreign policy expert, Randy Schuneman, that complaints were voiced against me, my family, and most of the B-team by a few folks on McCain's senior staff. They were angry that anyone in my family or group of Alaska friends had tried to set the record straight in the media without consulting with the campaign first. And they were still furious with me for speaking candidly on the Michigan withdrawal and the clothes issue. To this day, Randy, ever the gentleman, won't tell me everything that was said about the B team. But a couple of examples tell the story. They're screwing up, Schmidt told Randy one day in Schmidt's office, and the governor's not doing serious homework. Schmidt told Randy he thought I might be suffering from postpartum depression. That doesn't make any sense to me, Randy told Steve. What do you mean? I really don't understand. I've had significant interactions with the governor during the campaign, at the convention, in New York, all the days of debate prep under tough conditions. I'm with her a lot. You are not, Randy said. The Sarah Palin I've seen is not the one you're describing, and I don't understand how you're claiming that she's behaving this way except when I'm around. It doesn't make any sense to me. Randy and others told me after the campaign that it appeared a couple of the paid operatives were building up a stock of half-truths and innuendos concerning not just me, but each other to ensure that in the case of defeat, blame could be laid at someone else's feet. Randy wasn't the only one who thought so. At around the same time, the internet site Politico ran a story that claimed that Schmidt and his operatives had already put into motion a plan to destroy my reputation in order to save their own. He attributed his story to an unnamed source inside the McCain campaign. Other media outlets started reporting the same thing. Then, somewhere high inside the campaign, the gloves came off. Randy, I later learned, walked into a communications meeting in the campaign office and found about 8 communication people sitting around a U-shaped table, all buzzing over something big. One of the guys pointed to a computer screen and said, "Read this." It was a CNN story, byline Dana Bash. The headline read, "Palin's off-script comments irk McCain aides." And the article began, "Several McCain advisors suggested that they have become increasingly frustrated with what one aide described as Palin going rogue. A Palin associate, however, said the candidate is simply trying to bust free of what she believes was a damaging and mismanaged rollout. McCain sources say Palin has gone off message several times, and they privately wonder whether the incidents were deliberate. They cited an instance in which she labeled robocalls, recorded messages often used to attack a candidate's opponent, irritating, even as the campaign defended their use. Also, they pointed to her telling reporters she disagreed with the campaign's decision to pull out of Michigan." Bash went on to note that tensions like those within the McCain-Palin campaign are not unusual. Vice presidential candidates also have a history of butting heads with the top of the ticket. Randy finished reading the story. "I don't believe this," he yelled. "Those guys have gone too far this time." It may not be unusual for major ticket advisors to struggle internally over who calls the shots or to offer only tepid public support to one half of the ticket or the other, Randy later told me. But it is unheard of for campaign staffers to brazenly throw a candidate under the media bus with sleazy, anonymous comments. Randy stormed toward Schmidt's office and confronted his secretary. "Where is he? I want a cell number right now." The door to Schmidt's office opened, and suddenly he was standing there. Randy glared at him. "We've got to talk." They stepped inside. Randy slammed the door and told Schmidt what he really thought. "It is unbelievable that advisors, senior advisors, are calling the press and telling them the vice presidential candidate is a diva. This is unprecedented. It's unacceptable." Schmidt looked at Randy, poker-faced. "Who do you think it is? The leak. Is it Mark or Nicole?" "No, it's not," Schmidt said. "Who the hell else is it?" Randy said. "You guys have all been criticizing the governor like crazy." "Well, what about the Politico story?" Schmidt was referring to the piece in which an anonymous staffer had warned that McCain insiders were going to start taking me apart. "You think I was the source for that?" Randy asked. "No," Schmidt said. "Well, I wasn't, but that's minor. Now you've got these lies all over CNN. "It wasn't Nicole," Schmidt said. Randy laid out a very simple case. Picking a running mate was John's most important decision, and being loyal to John means being loyal to his pick. That makes what's going on absolutely atrocious. Schmidt started in again, telling Randy what an awful pick I was. The postpartum problems, the wardrobe scandal, legal exposure for Todd on Troopergate, whatever he meant by that. Somehow the Palins were responsible for all of the campaign's problems. "This is absolutely outrageous," Randy said. He started to walk out of the office, but Schmidt stopped him. Then, Randy says, Schmidt issued a threat that was veiled enough for deniability, but as clear as day if you were on the receiving end. If there were any more leaks critical of anybody in the handling of Sarah Palin, then a lot more negative stuff would be said about Sarah Palin. I knew none of that then, and Schmidt would later contradict Randy's account. At the time, I was just focused on finishing strong. I want to believe the tension between Schmidt and the B-team was a result of less than ideal circumstances in the pressure cooker of a national campaign and that it wasn't personal. But as I realized back in my Wasilla Mayer days, life is too short to hold a grudge. If I ever see Schmidt again, maybe I'll bring him a pretty white peace lily. At the start of the campaign, I had discussed with McCain's senior staffers my giving 3 key policy speeches, one each on energy, women's issues, and people with special needs. But September sped by, then October, finally with just 2 weeks to go before the election. I was scheduled to present our policy on special needs issues. Very good, I thought, remembering what had actually been my first campaign promise, that if John and I were elected, the special needs community would have an advocate in the White House. I could write the speech myself, weave in a lot of my family's experiences with Trig and with my nephew Karcher. I heard we were going to give the speech in a hotel ballroom. We'll find a small campaign audience to show up, headquarters said. The B team thought, come on, we can do better than that. What's the point of getting 40 Republicans in a room to listen to me talk? We've had thousands from the special needs community show up at our rallies, and surely there was such a community in Pittsburgh who would honor us with their presence at this event. Why not invite them to participate? Headquarters was actually receptive to that idea and got to work on making it happen. Then we found out, for the first time, that headquarters had employed a special needs coordinator who had provided a speech. The special needs coordinator also called the B team to say that we should no longer use the term special needs people because special needs families find it offensive. I guess I was behind the times. I looked the speech over and thought it was fine, but I also thought, anyone could give the speech. Where's my own connection to it? Where's Trig? Why should anyone care more about the issue after hearing this? So I reworked it and continued rewriting right up until the time I gave it, with the good people of the Woodlands Foundation, the Down Syndrome Center at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, Autism Link, the Children's Institute of Pittsburgh, and others in attendance. Too often, even in our own day, children with special needs have been set apart and excluded. Too often, state and federal laws add to their challenges instead of removing barriers and opening new paths of opportunity, I began. Too often, they are made to feel that there is no place for them in the life of our country, that they don't count or have nothing to contribute. I continued by saying that I loved it when the families of children with special needs came out to rallies and events. You bring your sons and daughters with you because you are proud of them, as I am of my son, I said. My little fellow sleeps during most of these rallies, even when they get pretty rowdy. He would be amazed to know how many folks come to see him instead of me. I love that fact. You know that there are the world standards of perfection, and then there are God's, and these are the final measure, I said. Every child is beautiful before God and dear to Him for their own sake, and the truest measure of any society is how it treats those who are most vulnerable. I went on to discuss specific policies the McCain-Palin administration would implement for special needs kids. For example, we would reprioritize some of the $18 billion a year Congress spends on its pork projects and instead fully fund the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. We're going to get our federal priorities straight and fulfill our country's commitment to give every child opportunity and hope in life. I talked about my efforts as a governor. I told them I knew John's and Cindy's hearts were with me on this issue. I wanted White House people and policies to show the respect and dignity these families deserved. We still get emails about that speech today saying, "This is why we connected with you. We felt you understood us." There wasn't much promotion of that message. I didn't want that for my own sake, Lord knows, but it needed to be shared. Republicans are often stereotyped as a pack of politicians without compassion. Here was a chance to show that caring hearts did beat at the center of the common sense conservative movement, and in effective ways that don't only call on government to deliver caring solutions, because government can't deliver caring solutions. We needed to explain that under GOP leadership, caring people would not be shut out by policies that discourage nonprofits, churches, and generous individuals, but instead would be empowered to continue their good work. I gave two more policy speeches, one on energy and one on women's issues, with a similar lack of promotion. That was a surprising strategy. I wished we could have done more. We asked whether we could expand the message, but by then it seemed, at least according to reports like the New York Times Magazine piece by Robert Draper, that headquarters might already have given up. The article telegraphed a defeatist mentality among some of the campaign operatives. That surprised the rest of us because we still had more than 2 weeks until Election Day, an eternity in politics. As the campaign drew to a close, my family and I were still pumped. We were having the time of our lives, and we ramped up our efforts to make clear to voters the distinctions between a McCain administration and an Obama administration, working to win a few more votes. In the final day before the election, John and I crisscrossed the nation separately in order to hit as many states as was physically possible. John touched down in Florida, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Indiana, New Mexico, Nevada, and Arizona. The VP team moved from the east to the west, also chasing the sun, and hit 7 rallies in Ohio, Missouri, Iowa, Colorado, and Nevada. Our families provided incredible support that day, speaking all over the nation at campaign events in key states. On November 3rd, we joined Chuck and Sally and Chuck Jr. and Jim and Faye Palin for a final late evening event in a high school gym in Elko, Nevada, then flew through the night to Alaska to cast our votes. Todd and all our parents were, in my opinion, some of the campaign's best advocates for John McCain's message. It was perfect that we got to wrap it all up together in a high school gym, just like the one we'd all been joined together in when Todd and I met 27 years earlier. We had begun the journey when we landed in Arizona for vetting on a pitch-black night. Now, in the early hours of November 4th, we landed in Anchorage in darkness, too. A fleet of Suburbans whisked us 50 miles from the airport to Wasilla, and when Todd and I arrived at City Hall, we were overjoyed to see crowds of friends and supporters standing in the frigid Arctic darkness, cheering on one of their own. I was so humbled and so excited to see everyone after the weeks away. It felt good to be home. After a round of handshakes and hugs, I stepped into City Hall. It was a full circle moment, the place where Todd and I cast our ballots for President and Vice President of the United States, was where I had attended the second grade, and later, all those city meetings. I was even wearing the same wardrobe I had often worn back then, jeans, a Carhartt jacket, and a relieved smile. I marveled at life's providential paths. Others may call such events coincidences. I believe they are miracles. Despite the previous all-nighter and the pundit's swan song for our ticket, I felt great. I felt thankful. After voting, we jogged across the street to the well-lit line of partisan demarcation to greet some dear friends and a large gathering of international reporters. Well, this is good, I thought. Our tiny town making news around the world. Jason Recker took a couple of phone calls, and I saw him shaking his head. Someone from headquarters was calling to tell the B team to put her back in the truck. The instruction was to not allow Todd or me to talk to reporters who had traveled all the way to Wasilla. Nah, not this time, I thought, and walked over to finally say hello. Afterward, we scooted back to the trucks and began the police escort motorcade back to Anchorage. After a quick run through a couple of coffee stands, we stopped at my brother-in-law's gas station for snacks. It seemed fitting that after some 100-plus interviews across 100-plus cities, plus 130 campaign events, some of them glitzy, our last off-the-record campaign stop was at an ordinary family business. As we boarded the campaign plane bound for Phoenix, I was confident but prepared to accept America's decision. Chris and I talked about the possibility of miracles. We honestly believed it could happen. We would not be surprised if voters entered the booth and pulled the lever for the GOP, despite what the poll said. No matter what happened, though, I knew that personally, I was much better off depending on God's plan, not my own. It's easy to forget that in the chaos of a national election. But when life invariably leads me back to that truth, my perspective changes and I find peace amidst all storms. Stepping back onto the plane, I silently acknowledged my human weaknesses, consciously handed my future over to God, and asked for His wisdom, strength, and grace. In the week leading up to the election, my speechwriter, Matthew Scully, and I, along with a quiet, level-headed speechwriter named Lindsay Hayes, worked on a speech I would give on election night. The national media had already given the McCain campaign last rites, but the B team refused to give up. By election day, Matthew, Lindsay, and I had two speeches in our back pockets, one victory and one concession. I wanted to make sure that in either case, the speech focused on two things: reminding Americans of what kind of man John McCain is and what he had promised to do for the country, and moving forward, uniting with the new administration while still holding it accountable where we disagreed. We were committed to this, to stand strong for America. Either way, I wanted to focus on giving a shout out to John and to tell our nation, thank you for the honor of a lifetime for my family and me. We are so proud to be Americans. I also wanted to say a word, finally, in appreciation of the Bush-Cheney administration's efforts. I was so happy to have my family and friends in Arizona with me. Todd's parents had flown in all the way from Dillingham, Mom and Dad and my siblings and their families, Todd's siblings and step-siblings. Martin Boozer, the Iditarod musher, had flown down with his wife. Todd's Iron Dog partner, Scott Davis, and his wife made the trip. Meg Stapleton, Chris, and her family, some of the kids' friends. And they were from all these different little towns across Alaska where you have to drive for hours or fly in a puddle jumper just to get to Anchorage so you can then leave the state. After that, it's a 4-hour trip just to get to the lower 48. Then another flight to get down to Arizona. I was glad that they'd all endured the journey to be together on this amazing day, especially since I'd hardly had time to give anyone the time of day since August 29th. I promised to make it up to everyone, and someday I will. During the crush of the campaign, family and friends, unfortunately, didn't always come first, a fact that nagged at me the whole time. Now I was looking forward to being able, finally, to take a deep breath and enjoy the last part of this ride together, no matter how it turned out. And we'd be enjoying it in this beautiful, warm desert city, instead of in a sub-zero land where even daylight was scarce this time of year. The Biltmore Resort was more like a complex than a traditional hotel. That meant that the rooms for everyone were spread out among the different buildings, with candidates and staff and family flung all over the place. In our room, Todd and the kids and I were with Chris and Meg as the election returns rolled in from the east to the west and flashed across the screen. We prayed for a miracle, but finally the moment came when it was clear to all of us in the room that we were not going to win. It was very, very disappointing. Yes, it had been a great contest and a historic election, and I still believed we had the stronger, smarter agenda for the country. It was unfortunate that our message didn't seem to take hold. As Vince Lombardi said, winning isn't everything, but wanting to win is. Yes, we had wanted to win, very much for America. In any case, I knew Matthew and Lindsay had done the campaign proud. It was time to step aside, but at least I was going to have this last moment to acknowledge my debt to John and thank him for giving me and my family and Alaska this incredible experience. I wanted to tell Americans to keep on fighting for what is right and not to let anyone tell them to sit down and shut up. As I got ready for the concession speeches, I noticed a lot of BlackBerry traffic, even more than usual. It was then that Jason said, "This is unbelievable. It sounds like you're not going to be giving the speech after all." Other staffers' mouths fell open. Someone poked their head into the room and said, "Governor, they want you over at Senator McCain's suite." I carried the speech to John's suite, wondering why headquarters would have had to spend all this time drafting a speech if I wasn't going to deliver it. John's suite was packed with campaign staff when we walked in. A senior staffer came over to me. "You know you won't be giving a speech," he said. "It's a powerful message," I told him. "Scully did a great job. It's a shout-out to John McCain and reminds the country that he's an American hero. This is all about unity and bringing the country together now." Then Schmidt waded in. "You're not giving one because it's never been done in the history of presidential politics," he said. "The vice presidential candidate does not give a concession speech." I knew he was wrong about that, but I wasn't going to argue with him. So I just said, "Steve, a lot of things have never been done before. John hadn't earned his reputation for independent thinking by doing things the way they'd always been done, and neither had I. Don't think of it as a concession speech," I said. "Think of it as a way of honoring the man we've been working for all these months." "Absolutely not," Schmidt said. "I don't even know why you wrote a speech. Nobody told you to." That set me back on my heels. I was surprised that he was surprised. I didn't find out until after the campaign where the idea of a concession speech had originated. It had come from the most natural source, Matthew Scully. About a week out from Election Day, he had realized that since I'd been a bit more visible than some vice presidential candidates, there was a good possibility I might be asked to speak on election night. John Edwards had spoken in 2004, and one of Scully's responsibilities as a speechwriter was to be proactive to make sure that the candidate was never caught without something to say. In Phoenix on Election Day, he met separately with both Rick Davis and Mark Salter and told them he'd been working on the speeches. "I have these ready just in case," Scully told Davis. "Okay, so she would speak before he does," Davis said. "We could do it that way. She could introduce him." "Okay, that could work," Davis said. Nothing was decided. Later, Scully told Mark Salter about the speeches. Salter, exhausted from flying all night, said something like, "Great, that sounds great." Again, nothing was decided. But of course, I didn't know any of that. Since headquarters had micromanaged everything I did and said for weeks, I had no idea that they hadn't been the origin of the speech. So when I got the news I wasn't speaking, it felt to me like some kind of punishment, a slap in the face. In truth, it was all a tangle of miscommunication and misunderstandings between worn-out people trying to cope with a shattering defeat. But in the heat of the moment, the conversation with Schmidt ended abruptly. I was ushered into a room where John was waiting. He sat in an upholstered chair, and other guys sat on the edge of the bed. Schmidt came in, too, and slouched in a chair like a pile of laundry. I felt bad for him, all his energy and efforts. He said he was leaving in the morning for some island. John had a conciliatory look on his face. "Hey, Sarah," he said, "we fought a good fight, and I'm going to just get out there and thank America." John smiled. "Well, you worked hard, and I want to get out there and thank you," I said. "No, these guys have it covered," he said, nodding in Schmidt's direction. "They've got it handled." I knew that was that. I thanked John again for everything and walked out of the room. I was still absorbing the no-speech decision when campaign handlers started rounding us up. "Let's go. Time to go to the stage. John's ready to go." "Wait a minute," I thought. "Where's my family? We're hardly dressed." Aunts and uncles and cousins had gathered from Washington to Texas for the final night, and no one knew where they were supposed to be or even when the speech was. The B team was scattered all over, too. Todd and I shook our heads. The experts still didn't get it. What mattered to us was showing respect for the everyday, hardworking folks who had put their lives on hold and dedicated everything they had, everything, to fight for what's right. It had been the most spectacular ride. A roller coaster, yes, but we'd do it all over again in a heartbeat, and we'd learn some lessons along the way. I felt this ending in Arizona deprived a lot of people of some joy that could still be salvaged from the night. "Wait a minute," I told the handlers. "My family. Let me get them organized." "No, no time. We have to go now." This isn't the way it's supposed to end, I thought. I walked toward the stage with just Todd and some of the kids, with a rolled-up speech in my hands that I wasn't going to give. I glanced around the area for any more of the five generations of our American family to share in this. Not many were around. It was a warm, starry Arizona night. The expansive stage had been set up with a spectacularly huge American flag behind us. "Excuse me, Governor," one of the McCain handlers said. "Just want to let you know, last-minute changes. Todd and the kids won't be allowed on the stage." "Oh," I said. Now they weren't just in the back of the bus. They were in the luggage compartment. Todd was again relegated to the belly of the plane. I chuckled at the imagery because he'd been there before, exactly 20 years earlier, and we'd loved our simple life then. On November 5th, 2008, I flew home to a political landscape that had permanently changed. The VP race had been an incredible, extraordinary ride, and I was still the same governor who had enjoyed tremendous and humbling citizen support just 68 days earlier. But that had all changed on August 29th, when John McCain and I teamed up to challenge a charismatic political figure who inspired worshipful loyalty from his supporters. The fallout was immediate. The governor's office was inundated with frivolous ethics complaints. Literally scores of Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, and Public Records Act requests rolled in, generating thousands of pages that required hours of work to process. Reporters abandoned actual reporting in favor of tabloidizing my family, my record, and me. Naturally enough, I had assumed that after the election, everything would go back to the way it was before. John McCain would go back to the Senate, and I would go back to the job I loved. But what a difference 10 weeks can make. Before my plane even touched down in Anchorage, shocking character assassinations of those I love had begun. Anonymous McCain campaign staffers were feeding lies to Fox News' Carl Cameron, who reported them without hearing our side of the story. I could roll with cheap shots against me, but the new blows against my family, my administration, and our state were over the top. Other inaccurate stories followed, including one in which it was reported that RNC lawyers were flying to Alaska to retrieve clothes stolen from the campaign. Ironically, the campaign had ordered the B-team to pack the fancy RNC wardrobe into the belly of our JetBlue plane and fly it back to Wasilla. There, Jason, Jeannie, and Bexy joined us in immediately inventorying it all, right down to the $70 nylons. Then Jason and Todd FedExed some 30 boxes of clothes and 14 empty suitcases to the RNC. The media's constant pelting reminded me of the times we kids used to go out in the canoe with Dad near the Kinnick mudflats early mornings before school. Fall was duck hunting season. There would be hunters all around us, and I would huddle up trying to stay warm as lead pellets rained down around us in the water. I'd peer through the dark early morning fog and grumble, "Geez, Dad, there's bullets flying around my head." He'd say, "Nah, that's just buckshot. Duck." It was almost funny, certainly ridiculous, the political buckshot critics fired our way. Nationally, pundits and reporters would criticize me for focusing on Alaska and not attending the celebrity-packed events we were invited to outside. Locally, the opposition would criticize me for focusing on national issues, as if I suddenly needed to become parochial and think of Alaska's issues as irrelevant to the nation. In Juneau, one Democrat lawmaker complained that I wasn't as sparky as before and that Piper and I no longer brought around bagels like we used to. The few times I hustled out of state to attend, for instance, a fundraiser for kids with special needs, my Juneau critics cried that they were being abandoned. Perhaps in another time and place, it would have been endearing to know that lawmakers, mostly Democrats, wanted me nearby. There's a pothole that needs repair on the Seward Highway. If she goes, who will fill it? But it was obviously disingenuous and absurd. Somehow my predecessors had been able to take extensive trips in the continental U.S. and abroad without anyone worrying that the state was at imminent risk of complete collapse the moment they left. But since August 29th, we were living in a new normal. Pundits seemed to assume that I was thinking only of my future on the national stage. And no matter how many times and in how many ways I repeated the plain fact that Alaska came first, the opposition interpreted every position I took through the prism of my supposed national ambitions. Every action we took or didn't take was fodder for the national media. It was a pathetic and chilling thing to watch because I knew we weren't the first this had happened to and won't be the last until Americans say enough. I don't like to hear people complain. I am the first to say, buck up or stay in the truck. You have a choice about how to react to circumstances, but I will state this complaint for the record. What used to be called mainstream national media are, in many respects, worthless as a source of factual information anymore. The sin of omission glares in their reporting. Perhaps national press outlets just don't have the resources anymore to devote to balanced coverage. Perhaps they've all just given up on themselves, so we've given up on them too, except to treat their shoddy reporting like a car crash. Sometimes you just have to look. The time has come to acknowledge that it is counterfeit objectivity the liberal media try to sell consumers. A period in the great American experiment has passed. We are moving into a new, more intelligent realm to gather information differently in order to hold our government accountable. Thank God there are still a few credible broadcasters on cable news, plus informative talk radio, common sense blogs, and some fine fact-based print publications. Beware of the left's attempts to silence these, as they have already with the bogus fairness doctrine, which attempts to blunt the force of conservative talk radio, and join me in being all over it when censoring efforts crop up. On June 7, 2009, Rudy Giuliani and his wife took Todd, our 14-year-old daughter Willow, and me to a Yankees game. Willow's friends back home texted her teasing messages because they saw her on TV. She was there in Yankee Stadium with Giuliani. Baseball, hot dogs, sunshine, and family time. It was one of the most incredible afternoons we got to spend together that summer. Later that week in Texas, I met with representatives of ExxonMobil and TransCanada Alaska to discuss their proposal to partner in building the natural gas pipeline under the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act. This partnership between the largest corporation in the world and the best pipeline construction company in the world would be an historic agreement. I was confident Alaska would be protected and excited for the agreement to be announced the next day. No doubt it would also be the biggest news to hit Alaska and certain sectors of the world's energy markets in years, and a strong step toward achieving energy independence for America. My family had joined me in Texas after the meeting, and they were eager to play for a day at our friend's house in the quaint, all-Western town of Giddings. I promised to join them after a couple of interviews to get the word out about the Gasline agreement. We would set up interviews with NBC's Matt Lauer and CNN's Wolf Blitzer that morning. Matt had been decent to date, and we liked his producer, Matt Glick. Wolf? Well, I like his mom. We negotiated the one mandatory term of the interviews. The first question had to be about the Gasline, not the tabloid stuff that people were making up. By then, we were fielding questions from reporters across the country who wanted a comment about a joke David Letterman had told on a CBS late-night show about Willow's visit to New York. He had made a crude reference to her having been knocked up in the seventh inning by Yankee infielder Alex Rodriguez. We had already learned that the national media's game was to bait us with caustic, untrue reports just so we would comment and they could make a story out of it. But this time I was caught off guard when radio host John Ziegler asked me about the Letterman clip because I hadn't seen it. I gave a quick answer, and from there the left turned it into a firestorm of accusations that we couldn't take a joke and that I had exploited my daughter because she had attended a baseball game with me. No, I guess I can't take a joke that suggests it's funny to humiliate a young girl and pretend that statutory rape by a 34-year-old man is something to laugh about. More telling, though, was the reaction by some women's groups and feminists who, as usual, stayed silent too long. If they couldn't articulate some concern, if not outrage, that this kind of humor was still acceptable to the detriment of young women who are already too often made to feel like sex objects by sexist older men, then these women's rights activists were hypocrites. We've all got megaphones. They just come in different sizes and styles. The one I was handed during the campaign gave me a platform to speak from regarding the path our nation is taking. I didn't ask for this megaphone, and obviously, after the campaign ended, the opposition would rather I didn't use it. But how can I be silent in the face of the serious issues facing my state and our country? What a selfish thing it would be to just zip my lips and coast comfortably along with a nice job, a secure paycheck, and government perks when I share the concerns of so many Americans. For example, I considered the Obama administration's panicky effort to stimulate the economy by spending enormous amounts of borrowed money short-sighted and ill-conceived. It defied the lessons of history and common sense. His nearly $1 trillion stimulus package was patently unfair both to future generations who will inherit our wasteful debt and to the everyday Americans who work very hard to pay the taxes that the administration seeks to spend at breakneck speed. While I was driving through Anchorage commuter traffic one evening, a radio news update reported that the White House was considering a second stimulus plan, even though the first one had not been measured for success, and deficit and unemployment rates were going through the roof. I turned that depressing news off. "Bristol, answer me this," I said as we drove from her barista job at an espresso cafe over to her Aunt Molly's house, where my grandson Trip was waiting for his mama. Bristol woke up at 4 a.m. most mornings to get to work, then took college classes late in the afternoon. We got to commute home together that day. She was working hard and, like any new mom, not getting much sleep. "You want to buy a coffee shop someday, right?" I asked. Say you investigate markets, scout locales, take business classes, you work on the side to invest in that coffee shop, and all along you know you'll be rewarded for your hard work to meet a demand for a quality product and good service. And you know you'll have to be brave enough to fail, right? This business would be your responsibility. You can't look to anyone to bail you out if you make poor decisions. You have to spend within your means and save for the future. I know, Mom, it's going to happen someday, Bristol answered. Lawton and I are going to do it. What should we call it? Doesn't matter. Call it Bristol's Beans. Sounds dumb, but what's your point, Mom? The point is, it's a great goal for you and your cousin to own your own business. But this administration hasn't figured out how to encourage small businesses, and that's the backbone of the economy. She lay back in the truck seat and closed her eyes. The more I heard about the new Democrat administration's economic philosophies, the more I feared for the future of free enterprise. Now I put a finer point on my advice to Bristol on opening a business. In fact, don't do this until this administration understands government's role in private business, or wait until they're out of office. I told Bristol she had a lot to consider in creating her business plan. Can you imagine setting up a business while the Democrat-led Congress is dictating how you should invest your money, the color of your roof, your source of energy generation, and what kind of health care insurance you must offer, and even the kind of cars you can have in your company fleet? My point was that government should get out of private enterprise as much as possible, not take it over. My administration had done so with the dairy industry in Alaska, with the result that a once limited, failing enterprise is now out from under government's thumb. All this went through my mind as I was driving through town with Bristol. Suddenly, she opened her eyes and looked over to teach me a lesson. What do you mean, don't do it? If everyone gives up their dreams to own a business just because someone in the White House is clueless about free enterprise, our country's going to tank, she said. You're always rah-rah America, so why say give up now? Bristol was wide awake now. You're always preaching that government can't make you happy, healthy, wealthy, or wise. Business owners are smarter than politicians give them credit for, and President Obama is wrong to think more government control is the answer. Pay attention to the tea parties, Mom. You're not alone in this. That's what they're saying. Bristol's barista wage, $7.15 an hour. Her advice to the president and her mom, priceless. My daughter closed her eyes again as we drove toward Molly's, and I thought of the long road ahead for Bristol and Tripp. She'd be fine because she was independent and strong and loved to work. And I loved her and her cousin Lawton's enthusiastic plans to own coffee shops as a side business while they were busy going to school and growing up. But Bristol and Tripp wouldn't be fine if pandering politicians buffaloed Americans into believing some utopian promise that big government could fix everything through more of the same meddling that had caused the economic failure in the first place. I didn't have a problem with sound, necessary projects to stimulate the economy that could be funded by our tax dollars. In Alaska, we'd use infrastructure funds to tackle deferred road maintenance and build access for more resource development. My problem was with the bureaucratic mandates attached to the programmatic part of the package. These were short-term, debt-ridden funds that would grow state government and hand more states' rights to the federal government. Many economists could see where this was headed. They described these rushed-through, barely-read proposals as nothing less than an assault on the free market. On the campaign trail, many had been hesitant to talk about legitimate fears that Obama's past comments and associations with anti-capitalist radicals would influence his economic policy. The press gave the impression that it was the wrong thing to do. I was going rogue when I answered reporters' questions about candidate Obama's associations and pals. I wish we had talked more about them and about Obama's close relationship with Acorn, the voter fraud specialist. But we did not elaborate on any of that during the campaign. Americans with common sense and a passing acquaintance with history do not agree that you can build a strong and sound economy by spending money we don't have and redistributing wealth. Common sense conservatives recognize that not only is there no justice in taking from one person to give to another, It doesn't work. Abe Lincoln reminded Americans, you can't lift up the poor by pushing down the very people who create jobs for them. The rich will simply move their wealth elsewhere, and the poor will wind up even poorer. Bristol slept, and as I drove, I got to think about her future and the country's future. America was built on free market capitalism, and it is still the best system in the world. No one explained this better than Margaret Thatcher, who noted that there's no alternative to capitalism because it's a system that ensures the most prosperity for the most people. Thatcher acknowledged that capitalism is not controllable or even predictable, but neither is human nature. Since its inception, capitalism has known slumps and recessions, bubble and froth. No one has yet disinvented the business cycle, and probably no one will. What is called the gales of creative destruction still roar mightily from time to time. To lament these things is ultimately to lament the bracing blast of freedom itself. My cabinet agreed that in challenging the stimulus package, we'd have to deal in reality. Legislators did hold the purse strings, after all, as they reminded us every day. Conservative governors all over the country were getting hammered for questioning use of the stimulus funds. Some legislatures, through threats of litigation, made it impossible to refuse the money. Litigation would be the next step for those either truly wanting to grow government or just wanting to obstruct a conservative agenda. I told our commissioners we'd have to appeal directly to friendly lawmakers and help educate the others. I highlighted a couple of obvious examples, such as the package of funds earmarked for the National Endowment for the Arts inside the General Education Funds package. I pointed out that there were higher priorities for our kids housed in leaky roof classrooms with underpaid teachers than funding more NEA projects. The other example was universal energy building codes that we'd have to adopt if we accepted a $25 million earmark for energy conservation. I feel like I'm beating my head against the wall trying to get legislators to understand there are fat strings attached to this, my deputy chief of staff, Randy Ruaro, said. Randy was a smart, mild-mannered young attorney who lived in Juneau. He had adopted an adorable child, a native boy named Dylan, who played hide-and-seek with Piper in the Capitol hallways when we worked weekends. Randy was frustrated with the legislator's claim that the federal cash was as good as free money. He printed sections of the stimulus package, as well as current Federal Energy Department guidance, highlighted specific pages, and handed them out to lawmakers and reporters. The documents clearly stated that acceptance of the funds required the adoption and enforcement of energy building codes. Universal building codes in Alaska, a practical libertarian haven full of independent Americans who did not desire help from government busybodies. A state full of hardy pioneers who did not like taking orders from the feds telling us to change our laws. A state so geographically diverse that one-size-fits-all codes simply wouldn't work. I vetoed those building code funds. After a Fairbanks speech on the subject, I knew I'd be criticized for sounding like the mom that I am, but so be it, I had to remind Alaskans one last time of our opportunities. We don't have to feel that we must beg an allowance from Washington, except to beg the allowance to be self-determined. See, in order to be self-sufficient, Alaska must be allowed to develop, to drill and build and climb to fulfill our statehood's promise. At statehood, we knew that we were responsible for ourselves and our families and our future. And 50 years later, we cannot start believing that government is the answer. It can't make you happier, healthier, wealthier, wise. What can? It is the wisdom of the people and our families and our small businesses and industrious individuals. And it is God's grace helping those who help themselves. And then this allows that very generous voluntary hand up that we are known to enthusiastically provide those who need it. The crowd that attended the speech in the warm Fairbanks sun that day humbled me by giving those words a standing ovation. The unaccustomed warmth must have worn out a few of the legislators in the audience, though, because they remained seated. And just weeks later, after Sean Parnell took over as governor, the Democrat-controlled legislature overrode my veto. An hour later, now driving across the Palmer Flats with Bristol, I turned the radio back on just in time to hear talk of another anti-tax tea party. Just what I needed to hear to spark hope again. I had to believe enough Americans were listening, watching, learning what was going on in their White House with their Congress, and that they weren't going to just sit quietly and buckle up while those in Washington took the country for a ride. We were almost home when Bristol stirred and yawned. She must have been reading my mind the whole ride. "Bristol's beans is dorky, Mom," she finally mumbled. Okay, she was right about that. But I was at least right about our economy.